Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 29 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed, that's for sure. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You can go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Also, be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year he'll be publishing two books, Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area, and another book about the famous Ganella shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for the plug, Ronnie. Always appreciated. That promo sounds good. Thank you very much. Well, tonight we're in for a dynamic and dynamite, intriguing broadcast. We have our featured guest, Mr. Ron Kessler, New York Times best-selling author of the book titled The Secrets of the FBI. Ronald Kessler reveals the FBI's most closely guarded secrets and the secrets of celebrities, politicians, and movie stars uncovered by agents during their investigations. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the past week, we'd like to announce it's our 36th show already, buddy. No turning back the clock now. We're just thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and maybe one or two not so positive, but we'll take the good with the bad, right?
You can't please everybody, but we've got an international audience, so we're quite pleased at our progress.
You bet. It's certainly something to cheer and wave the flag about.
Right.
I'd like to thank our production people, especially at Artist First World Radio Network, for making the show possible. Like I said before, Ronnie Boy, internet radio is a place to be. It's great to be recognized. And, I guess it proves we're right on track. Hey, Ronnie, I'd like to say hi to my good buddy, Chi-Chi Yurima from Toronto, Canada. He's listening in tonight. Had a chance to chat with him about the show. He's a real fan of our show. And most importantly, he wanted to talk about the Yankees-Tigers game tonight in progress. So let's get on with the show so we can watch the last seven innings, buddy.
Okay, bye.
Now, here's this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Angus McFarlane of Glasgow, Scotland. He writes, listen to your broadcast with Nina Burley last week. Your guest gave a compelling look at the Italian justice system. It was not only the young American woman on trial, but the whole Italian judicial system that was put under the magnifying glass. Good job, lads, he writes. Hey, thanks, Angus. Anything to add to that, Ron?
Yes, I think it was something that was expected if we wanted justice. And I emailed Nina Burley, who was our guest for that show. I saw her on MSNBC talking about Amanda Knox when she came back to the States. And I asked her for a quick quote, and she said, justice was done, the Italian system prevailed. It works, and I think it does. The jury made the right decision based on the DNA evidence, and she talked about that during the interview and dissected, you know, the whole case. And I think you can only but conclude that she had to be set free. So we're happy about that.
Yeah, we sure are. And let's get on to our second mailbag item. Giovanni Pasqualino Giovanni Pasqualino from Rome, Italy writes, I listened to and enjoyed your show over the weekend with Nina Burley. The interview was a good preview of the acquittal verdict of Amanda Knox earlier in the week. We were bombarded with this story every day in Italy. I'm happy it's over. Well, some great comments there, Ronnie. Anything
well,
to add?
It's kind of flattering to have somebody in Italy respond listening to our show, and we're glad that that he enjoyed it.
You bet. Yeah, thanks a lot for listeners to write in.
And really we have to apologize for mangling his name.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We'll call him Gio.
You bet. Well, Ronnie Boy, you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Well, next week we got a real special treat. We've got none other than Henry Hill, Goodfellas, the famous gangster, probably the second best crime movie ever made after The Godfather, Goodfellas.
Yeah.
And he's going to be on, and it's going to be a great show. He's been really active since he left the Federal Witness Protection Program.
Yeah.
He's got a book on Italian cooking. My wife's going to try one of the recipes. It's called The Mafia Cookbook.
Wow.
And he's very outspoken, and we've got about a zillion questions to ask Henry Hill. And I know we've got a lot of interest from our listeners because they're wondering whatever happened to Henry. And it's the 25th anniversary of the best book ever written. It inspired me to get into true crime writing.
Wow.
You know, and Wise Guy by Nicholas Pelagi. Without doubt, the best book on crime ever written, and that inspired the movie Goodfellas.
Yeah, well, a great movie, a great book, fantastic. I'm looking forward to that show. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. A rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, October 5th. Baltimore, Maryland. Killing El Awlaki was a political stunt unworthy of a great nation. Hey, Ronnie, some government officials are claiming that the United States-born anti-American Islamic cleric Anwar El Awlaki was killed in self-defense by a CIA-operative drone. Hey, Ronnie, does the government think the public will buy this nonsense?
Well, nobody's questioning it. And you know, I mean, I was really happy when I heard that he was taken out of commission. You know, that was my reflex action. And then, you know, I started to think about it when Ron Paul, you know, started to complain and said it was an impeachable offense. It was very strange. You had Bill Maher and Salman Rushdie on one side defending, Obama's actions, and then you had guys like Michael Savage, he was a real right-wing commentator on radio, and Ron Paul, you know, attacking him. And I was just wondering if they would have been supportive of Obama's killing of Awlaki, if they would have been George Bush. But this raises a lot of questions, about this action. There's evidently Reuters reporting there's a secret panel that can put Americans on a kill list, believe it or not. And evidently, El Awlaki was on that secret panel of government officials, and it's supposed to be decisions of the panel, and it's that subset of the White House's National Security Council. And there's no law establishing its existence or setting out any rules by which it's supposed to operate. So, you know, there's no public record, there's no accountability, and no one seems to be getting anxious about it. Now, if you're going to go out and kill American citizens abroad, I mean, there's got to be some kind of procedures in place, and there's got to be a debate about whether it's legal or not, but there's absolutely nothing going on about that.
That's right. You know, I tell you, we just don't have, we haven't formulated a coherent legal doctrine that effectively deals with such instances, I'm afraid to say.
Right.
I'm telling you.
Right.
Well, let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, October the 1st, 2011. Manchester, New Hampshire. Texas Governor Perry suggests military role in Mexican drug war. Hey, Ronnie, Republican President candidate Rick Perry said last Saturday he would get the United States military involved in Mexico's drug and drug cartels. You know, I'll tell you something, this guy's losing a lot of traction on that comment. Any remarks on that?
Yeah, you know, this subject is very close to my heart. I did 6 books on the war, on drug trafficking in my career, but, you know, they say Perry isn't a great debater. He's also a great thinker. This is an idea like a bunch of drunk guys in a bar would come up with. I mean, you know, you're talking about going into a foreign country, dealing with Mexican U.S. relations. You got 38,000 Mexican troops that can't deal with the situation. The drug cartels de facto control about 30% of the of the country, and it would be another mess. It would be another war. You know, we're here in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now they're talking about going into Mexico, and really the whole focus is on the wrong end. It should be on demand. It should be on U.S. policy, this failed war on drugs policy we've had since early 70s when Nixon declared war on drugs, and it's been pursued by seven presidents, including Obama.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ronnie, this guy, you know, he jumped into a hornet's nest with that statement. And
He's tried to retract it, but ABC News reported that Perry had long touted this idea about sending U.S. troops to Mexico. So, you know, it's something that, he's thought about for a long time, and it's not something he just came off the spur of the moment and misspoke.
Yeah, well, let's keep an eye on that story. It's fascinating ideas he's got. I'm not sure if he's going to get anywhere with those. And now, just before we get on to our very special guest, Mr. Ron Kessler, author of Secrets of the FBI, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy the show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's show features award-winning author Mr. Ron Kessler. In his turn-pager and fascinating book titled Secrets of the FBI, the New York Times best-selling author presents revelations about the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound, the recent Russian spy swap, Marilyn Monroe's death, Vince Foster's suicide, and J. Edgar Hoover's sexual orientation. From Watergate to Waco, from congressional scandals to the killing of bin Laden, the Secrets of the FBI presents headline-making disclosures about the most important figures and events of our time. It's going to be a great show, Ronnie, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Ron Kessler.
Hey, thank you.
Well, I'm telling you, this was a really interesting read, and I was telling you before the show that it should have been subtitled Beyond Marilyn Monroe, because there's a lot of interesting information. I'm just wondering what kind of reaction you've gotten since the book came out, and it's only been out for, I guess, 2 months, right, August?
Yes. Always mixed bag. I think FBI people are pretty happy with it. There are some old-timers who grumble about some of my conclusions about Hoover, I think a lot of people are amazed at the fact that the FBI gave me how they break into homes and offices to plant bugging devices without getting caught and shot as burglars.
Right. The tacked-off program, right?
That's right.
Right, we'll talk about it later.
So even within the FBI, there's some eyebrow raising, but actually Bob Mueller, the FBI director, personally approved giving me this material, and I still can't believe it, that it's in the book.
Well, you know, it's a tribute to you as a journalist, and maybe we should give yourself give the listener some background on you to show that you have the background to gain the trust of the FBI to do a book like this responsibly. Go ahead, please.
I was on the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. I left that in 85 to write books, and I've now written 19 books. I'm also chief Washington correspondent of Newsmax.com. And I've written, a lot of my books have been either on the FBI or on the CIA or related to that. I've been in that field for some time, and people say, how do you get them to talk? Well, usually I would waterboard them. That worked very well.
Right, and you're with Newsmax, right?
Yes.
What is that? It's a really respectable news organization on the Internet.
Yeah.
It's got something like 7 million hits.
You got it, 7.7 million unique visitors a month, and it gives me an opportunity to write about a wide range of topics from the FBI to politics and keep up with some of the latest cases, such as Jonathan Pollard, for example. I just recently had a story saying that, quoting the case agent on the Pollard case as saying that before he started spying for Israel, he actually tried to spy for Australia, which didn't want him. So he's not exactly the great Israeli patriot that he's been portrayed
right.
as.
But from what I understand, I haven't heard much lately, the Israelis have really put pressure on the U.S. government to try to get him released, right?
Yeah, and you would think that a story like this will undercut that because, it turns out he was
right.
in it for the money and the excitement and not at all, not that it should make any difference, but not at all because he had the best interests of Israel at heart.
Right. So you had this idea to do this book, right? How'd you go about starting it and researching it and access to the FBI?
Yeah, I essentially just hit up any current or former FBI person to glean the very best secrets, and I sifted through. You know, I'd say I used 1 out of 20 of all the items that I actually knew about. I just wanted to keep this to something that people really would want to grab a hold of and read, but at the same time learn about the FBI and how it really operates, as opposed to some of the myths that we see in the media.
Right. Well, what type of documents or type of information did they give you access to? They didn't just say, here's the room full of documents, you know, come in and help yourself. They must have had some kind of screening process.
Yeah. You know, I pretty much stuck to interviews, not documents, because very frequently that's the best way to get the very
right.
best secrets. You know, for example, I found that just after Marilyn Monroe's death, a teletype came into headquarters, and I got this from on the record from Carter DeLoach, who was one of Hoover's top aides,
right.
Saying that from the head of the Los Angeles field office, saying that just before her death, he had lent his personal car to Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General, to go see her secretly. And then I confirmed with his kids, because he's since died, that in fact on a regular basis he would do that. He would give his car to Marilyn to go see Bobby to go see Marilyn. So, you know, just an example of something that's not necessarily related to any FBI investigation, but a secret that FBI agents know. And another one was on Vince Foster's suicide. He did commit suicide. He was the deputy White House counsel under Bill Clinton, and he was depressed. But about a week before his death, the FBI found that Hillary Clinton had a big meeting in the White House with him and other aides about her health care legislation, and he disagreed with one of the provisions, and she just violently lit into him and ridiculed him in front of all these other White House aides and said, you're just a small-town hick lawyer, you'll never make it in the big time. And after that, the FBI found that his demeanor changed, he became very withdrawn and would break into tears easily, and then a week later he committed suicide. And so the FBI concluded that that is what triggered his suicide. Again, something that never came out before.
Right. Was that in the records, or was that through
no,
interviews?
This is interviews.
Right.
And these were agents who were working for Ken Starr and all that.
Right.
His secret.
Right. Well, what's the final word on Vince Foster? You know, there's a lot of controversy during the Clinton years about Vince Foster. A lot of people thought he was murdered and all that.
Yeah.
Well, what did you conclude after interviewing these FBI agents?
That it was a suicide. You know, when I looked over all the a lot of the forensic evidence and the medical examiner's report and what the FBI concluded. And, you know, this is so common whenever there's some high-profile death that's unexplained or unexpected. People start coming up with conspiracy theories, and every now and then they're right, but
right.
most of the time they're not.
Right. Well, you know, it must have been a little delicate for you, because you're dealing with one of the most controversial public figures in U.S. history, J. Edgar Hoover. And, you know, he has his reputation, sexual preference, you know, which we're going to talk about and all that. Was that a factor in trying to get access? Did they sort of, you know, there was a certain areas you couldn't touch were doing interviews?
Yeah, you know, the modern FBI really doesn't care that much about Hoover one way or the other. They're not trying to protect him or sensitive about him. And what I concluded in the book was... I actually interviewed FBI agents who were on Hoover's security detail, and they described how every evening they would pick up Hoover and Tolson at headquarters and bring Tolson to his apartment on Cathedral Avenue, and then drop off Hoover at his home, and then they would stay at Hoover's home all night, and that was the end of it. There was never any, you know, back and forth. But on the other hand, Hoover and Tolson, his deputy, spent almost all their free time together. They would have breakfast and lunch and dinner together. Not breakfast, but lunch and dinner. They would go on vacations together. Mm-hmm. They would take adoring pictures of each other. And then Hoover left his entire estate to Tolson,
right.
worth about $3 million in today's dollars. So
right.
I concluded that they had a spousal relationship. It could have been sexual, but it may not have been. It could be that, you know, Hoover was homosexual and just suppressed it or was in denial, but definitely not you know, the normal heterosexual relationship. Hoover lived with his mother until she died, and he was 43 years of age.
Right.
So on the other hand, the claim that Hoover engaged in cross-dressing and wore a red dress at the Plaza in New York, that's totally made up by one Susie Rosenstiel, who had been convicted of perjury,
mm-hmm.
and then was used in an author's book. And of course, that myth will never die.
Right. Well, your book is fair in that way, because it has, you know, both pro and con about Hoover. And one of the things you pointed out, which was quite interesting, you wrote that, you know, under Hoover, the FBI was pioneering in applying science to solving crimes. And can you talk a little bit about that? And what, because, you know, he's also ridiculed for denying the existence of the mafia.
Right.
You know, on the other hand, but this was quite interesting because that was very important for their development, right?
Yeah, I mean, he really was the creator of the FBI, which is the most admired law enforcement agency in the world, and was very technologically advanced. He started the laboratory, which was very unusual in those days. He started the fingerprint operation and the filing system, which was so important because, of course, there are no computers,
right.
and that was very advanced. He also insisted that there be no brutality when police brutality was very common.
Mm-hmm.
But then he engaged in massive abuses, especially as he advanced in age. He was director for 48 years, and really, in many ways, more powerful than presidents because
right.
he was feared. One thing he did to keep his job is he would have these blackmail material, blackmail files, with titillating information about members of Congress, about presidents. He would make sure that they knew that he knew, and so of course he was untouchable.
Right.
And go ahead.
Well, we can talk a little bit about that. But you know, you also point out candidly that he did abuse his position. He became, you know, it was an example of absolute power corrupts, because he had employees building a front porch, a fish pond, you talk about that, a rear deck in his house, and then you talked about some of them prepared his tax returns, and even the book, Masters of Deceit, which I actually read back when I was in college, was ghostwritten on that.
Yeah.
When did this start? You know, when did he start becoming like this, when he started, that he was bigger than the position?
I'd say in the last 10 years he really got out of control, although even before that he would engage in illegal wiretapping and gathering blackmail material. And on why he would not recognize the mafia when everybody else in the country knew that there was a mafia,
mm-hmm.
I believe it was because the same reason he kept the blackmail materials, he wanted to keep his job, and he was afraid that if he went after mayors or members of Congress who were in the control of the mafia, he could be unseated himself.
Right.
So that I think explains a lot about
right.
Hoover.
Right. So he is that to say that he gathered all of this secret information because he was insecure about his position, about his power and his place in Washington?
Yeah, he was insecure. He wanted to keep his job, but he also was a personally insecure individual. He had this expression, "Don't embarrass the bureau," meaning don't embarrass him. He was very meticulous about the personal conduct of agents, and part of it was, you know, he felt that if there was any besmirching of FBI agents, it would reflect on him, and again, he would lose his job. Deep down, I think he was an insecure individual.
Right on that. There is a movie coming out on Hoover, I understand, from Leonard DiCaprio, and he must have talked about that with some of these agents. And I can't see DiCaprio playing Hoover, so it's going to be interesting to see what the makeup they do on him. But what does the FBI think of that? Because it's probably going to be very, very blunt in its treatment of Hoover.
Yeah. You know, again, the modern FBI, you know, is focused on catching terrorists and doesn't really care that much about Hoover, but the Society of Former Agents and agents from that time period are upset. You know, I understand that the movie's going to show Tolson trying to kiss, making a move to kiss Hoover. I think that's as far as it goes, and they just don't like that. But it's not a monolithic group, and they all have different opinions.
Right. Are they going to cooperate in the film? I think it's Martin Scorsese, right? One of the most powerful directors in Hollywood.
Clint Eastwood.
Eastwood's doing it?
Yeah. It's coming out next month.
Yeah.
Called J. Edgar. Uh-huh. It should help promote my book, I hope. It should, create a lot of controversy.
Right. On that, going to be...
Ron, were you consulted in that movie production at all?
No, they actually did their own research. They actually interviewed some of the old-timers, so I think they, at the same time they did what movies do, they added some novelistic touches, such as the one about Tolson trying to kiss Hoover. But again, if you think of, someone who actually goes on vacation with another man, leaves his estate to this man, that tells you a whole lot.
Right. Just for the record, what happened to Tolson after Hoover died?
He died just about 2 years later. He was buried next to Hoover, and there was a big deal about Hoover's dogs.
Right.
They were buried some other place, some people think he's still there in the basement of the FBI and he's going to come back.
When did Hoover start collecting these secret files, and who did he target? What type of personality did he target in Washington?
Anybody who was powerful, and not only members of Congress and presidents, but as we know, the Beatles, any Hollywood figure. Part of it was also so that he could share these tidbits with presidents and titillate them. But part of it was just so that everybody would be afraid of him. And even if people didn't think he had anything on them, they still were afraid. They still were aware that he has these files. It was amazing. Just amazing.
But what's amazing in your book, you point out that not only did he have these secret files, but he wanted to make sure they knew that he had these secret files, right? And how did he do that?
Well, what he would do is he would send over an agent, let's say, to a member of Congress, and the agent would say, I understand you had this problem with this prostitute last night, but of course we won't say anything about it. And that was, of course, enough to put that person in his pocket. And I had one other example of how this worked. I quoted on the record Roy Elson, who was the administrative assistant to Senator Hayden, who didn't like the idea of giving more money to Hoover's new FBI building. So the FBI sent over an agent who talked to Elson and said, of course he knows about the affairs that Elson is having. Elson was married at the time. And Elson told me on the record that he said back to this agent, well, I hope you have photos because I want to show the boss.
Right.
And that was the end of that blackmail attempt, but that is the way it worked.
Right. Willie, let's take a station break and we'll be back with our fascinating guest.
You bet, you bet. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist's First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsik and Will Harib. We've got a fascinating guest tonight, Mr. Kessler, who wrote the book Secrets of the FBI. Now back to Ron and Ron Kessler.
Right. Well, we're back with Ron Kessler, The Secrets of the FBI, and I can recommend it. I read it, and it's just really a quick read. It's written very, very well, journalistic style, and you can do it in one or two nights. Ron, you've got a website, right, where people can go to find information?
Yeah, ronaldkessler.com, and the book is available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore.
Right, and they could also follow you on Newsmax, right, newsmax.com?
Yeah, I'm a chief Washington correspondent on Newsmax, and Newsmax, as we said, has 7.7 million unique visitors a month.
Right. Thank you for that information, and... I was just wondering, was there anything that you uncovered that you didn't put in the book that you thought, well, this is maybe over the top, and I shouldn't put this in the book?
No, I'm thankful that I didn't have to make that kind of decision. I was able to present everything that I thought would be of interest, and bring it as far as I could.
Right. On that, what was the most surprising revelation in your research? You must have had some preconceived ideas about some of the subjects. What was the most surprising?
Well, one of the biggest revelations was how Robert Hansen was actually caught as the FBI agent who turned out to be a spy in the FBI. And at first the FBI thought it was somebody else. But the movie Breach totally misportrays how that happened. It credits Eric O'Neill, who was this low-level support employee, with really being the hero. And in fact, he did very little. Mm-hmm. It was actually Mike Rochford, an FBI agent, who developed the source, who actually gave up Hansen. But I think, you know, the most astonishing material in the book, and it's about 20% of the book, is how they break into homes and offices to plant right. bugging devices.
Right.
I was just stunned by that material.
Right.
You know, as I said before, they could be shot as burglars, especially, let's say, if they're going to an embassy and they're caught in the middle of the night. And they do this in terrorist cases, mafia cases, spy cases. But what they do is, several weeks before the break-in, they will conduct surveillance of the premises, and they'll see who goes in, who goes out, and then on the night of the break-in, mm-hmm. they'll watch. They'll have agents watch anybody at their home who might go back, and if they do start to go back to the premises, they will divert them. They'll have a dress as a police officer and stop mm-hmm. them, or they'll stage a phony traffic accident, or they'll open a fire hydrant in the area so nobody can go back. They also take a photo of any dog that might be on the premises beforehand, and they show it to a veterinarian who's on contract, mm-hmm. and he prescribes just the right amount of tranquilizer to shoot into the dog with a dart gun. And then at the end of the break-in, they wake up the dog again. They don't want to have any sleepy dogs around who might create suspicion.
Right. Well, you wrote that they do this hundreds of times each year.
Yeah, 400 times a year.
Right, and did they ever slip up? Did they ever not make it out in time?
Yeah, well, there have been close calls, and there's one case where it was not the TAC ops people. It was FBI technical agents. So they're not as experienced and well trained in the Cincinnati field office, who actually had to shoot and kill an individual who came at them with a revolver because they were putting a GPS tracking device mm-hmm. under the car of this individual, and he came out at 4 a.m. and thought these guys were, you know, burglars or something, or trying to mm-hmm. steal a car. And he wouldn't put down the gun. They said, FBI, put it down. No, he wouldn't, and they shot him.
Right.
But other times, for example, there was a mafia situation in New York where a mafia guy was about to do a hit job, and he was going to pick up his shotguns and other weapons in this mafia-controlled apartment. And so these two FBI agents from the TAC Ops teams were putting bugs in this apartment, and mm-hmm. they thought this guy was not around, but it turned out he was. He was, and they heard the key in a lock. So what do? They jumped in the bathroom. One of the agents got behind a shower curtain, had his gun drawn. The other agent turned on the water in the sink, and when this guy came in, this agent pretended that he belonged there, and he said, "What the F are you doing here?" And the hitman, you know, seemed to fall for that. And at the end, the hitman left, and he said, "Don't forget to lock the door behind you."
That's really funny. Well, they did this on John Gotti too, which I thought was interesting.
You know, what they did with him was they put bugs in his social club and an apartment above it, in various electrical outlets and electrical switches, so that the bugs had power. They didn't have to put in batteries. Another trick is they will introduce static on the line of, let's say, a mafia guy yeah. at his home. He calls repair service. Well, of course, it's the FBI that intercepts the call. They say they'll be right over, and sure enough, they go over in a telephone company truck wearing telephone company mm-hmm. uniforms, and they fix the phone, but meanwhile they put a bug in the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And another story out of Philadelphia was the agents had to put bugs in a mafia front, which was an electronics store, and they didn't want to go in the back because the back could be booby trapped, so they had to go in the front. They figured 1 or 2 a.m. was the best time. After 2 a.m. is when trash trucks started to come out. But the problem was that this place overlooked an all-night bar across the mm-hmm. street. Well, how do they break in without being seen? What they did was they borrowed a city bus, and they drove the bus in front of the premises. They got out. They put the hood of the bus up to pretend that this bus had broken down. So they got out, they picked the locks, the bus then drove away and came back to pick them up after they put the bugs in. Well, the bus went by a bus stop, and there were two patrons in the bar at the bus stop, and the bus, of course, didn't stop for them, and they became furious. They went running for the bus when it stopped in front of the electronics place, and they jumped in, and then the agents who were there in the bus were all from different field offices, so they didn't realize that these guys don't belong with them. But then some of the agents started taking off their weapons and their walkie-talkies, and these guys started ringing to get off, let me off, ding, 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 ding. And the agent who was driving the bus thought they were just joking around, didn't get it, said, stop bothering me, I'm having enough trouble driving this bus. And then another agent got up, and he had a shotgun on a strap or on his shoulder. And then these guys really went, ding, 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 let me off. And finally they let him off. They went running down the street, and no one ever heard from them again.
That's really funny. Going back to the Gotti and the social club, did they find anything interesting on Jean Gotti?
Oh, yeah. They got, you know, tapes of him ordering murders, discussing murders, enough to totally convict him.
Right. To help convict him on that.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned war and terrorism, but this is beyond war and terrorism, too. It's organized crime, right, this attack ops program.
Well, it's everything. It's all those things. You know, for example, when there was an alleged terrorist who wanted to blow up the home of George W. Bush last summer in Dallas, the agents put bugs in his apartment, and that helped develop evidence. They also will make copies of hard drives, ferret around, get any kind of evidence whatsoever in the middle of the night.
I know some of our listeners are listening, and they're wondering, what's the legal basis for this? I mean,
it's all authorized by court order.
So they have to get a court order, and does the court automatically rubber stamp these petitions from the FBI to do this?
They almost always approve them, but you know, the FBI obviously develops a lot of evidence beforehand before they apply for these orders.
Yeah.
Ronnie, I got a question. I'm
going
to jump in with one if you don't mind, Mr. Kessler. We talked earlier in our rap sheet item about the assassination by the government of Anwar al-Awlaki. My question is, what is the FBI's role in combating terrorism like this?
Well, the FBI actually, you know, has been very successful in combating terrorism. That's one reason we haven't had an attack. Every few months there are roll-ups, arrests of terrorists by the FBI, sometimes with tips from the CIA. The FBI has not engaged in any of these actions outside of the courts. They do give Miranda warnings. They don't engage in enhanced interrogation. They feel that they can develop cooperation without that. And for an example, with the Christmas Day bomber, for this book, The Secrets of the FBI, I interviewed Art Cummings, who was in charge of FBI counterterrorism until last year, and that was his case. And he said, at first, the individual did start talking, and then he clammed up. They did give him a Miranda warning, but then the FBI went over to Nigeria and convinced his uncle to come back to the U.S. and convince his nephew to cooperate, and sure enough, he did start cooperating again. So that's, you know, an example of how the FBI can sweet-talk these people and get cooperation.
That's really interesting. I had a couple more questions on the Tech Off program. I'm going to look around my house for the bug. What does it look like?
Yeah, and watch out for those FedEx guys and those UPS guys, because they could be FBI as well. You know, they actually showed me a real bug. I couldn't believe it. It was the size of a postage stamp and just a little bit thicker, and that particular one could record for 20 hours or could transmit as you wish, all in stereo. And that's just one example. Well, you know, one thing they will do is, let's say they want to bug a home, they may take a picture of a vase inside, or they'll send someone posing as an exterminator inside to take a picture, and then they'll make a replica of that vase and put a bug in it, and then, of course, switch that with the other vase. They have their own engineers, their own machinists. It's all undercover in Virginia. They have as many as 50 different uniforms, FedEx, UPS, all kinds, any kind of truck you want. They will sometimes even, in one case, stage a party on a yacht in order to get the bad guys away so that
you mentioned that those six beautiful women about that. That was quite interesting.
They had the prettiest FBI agents.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting that they could recruit a beautiful woman for that.
Absolutely, yeah. Very ingenious, very, very creative. The way I was able to get this is, you know, there's always some serendipity involved. I was interviewing the head of the Washington field office, and he said, "Did you talk to Louis Griever?" And I said, "No, who's Griever?" And he said, "Well, he's in charge of the tactical operations teams and the laboratory and fingerprinting, and he was on these teams himself for 12 years. I didn't even know what tactical operations was.
Right.
You know, it's really a big euphemism."
Right.
And sure enough, Griever was amenable, and he's now executive assistant director of the FBI, so he had the authority to grant access and to decide to give me this material. And at the same time, he knew all the stories, and he was able to even let me interview current agents who do this and former agents who do this. He did get approval from Mueller, as I said, but I never in my life dreamed that I would be given this material.
Well, you know, suppose on this program here we started, you know, ranting about, say, the government's policy on war on terrorism, and I may do something stupid like Hank Williams did, called Obama, you know, a Hitler. Would that make me eligible for something like this?
You never know. You better check those UPS guys next time they come.
Are you bugged?
I think I would know if I was bugged. I got enough sources.
You're right. Are you paranoid now?
I did have, you know, one of these people over to my house for dinner, and I said, you know, I have an ADT alarm system just to make it easier for you.
Good for you.
Let's take another break, Willie, and we'll be back with our fascinating interview about the secrets of the FBI.
That's for sure. What a great interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Now here is Ron Chepsik and Ron Kessler, author of a fascinating book titled Secrets of the FBI.
Right.
Now
so
back to Ron and Mr. Kessler.
It's the Ron and Ron show tonight.
You
I'm
bet.
Here. We're talking about Secrets of the FBI, and Ron has a website, ronkessler.com. You can go to. The book is on its way to becoming a bestseller, so you could pretty well get it anywhere, Amazon, and you want to check out Newsmax.com as well on that. And let's move on. Probably what I think most people want to hear about is Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. What type of information did you uncover about that relationship?
Well, you know, based on what I was told on the record, Bobby would see Marilyn secretly on a regular basis, borrowing the FBI agent's car, which was a white Lincoln Continental. You know, obviously they were having an affair, and I think the timing suggests that Bobby broke up with her, and that's why she committed suicide. I think that's pretty.
So you think that's pretty definite then?
Yeah, that's pretty inescapable.
Right. Well, Robert Kennedy evidently knew because that this was going on, right? Because, you know, that was Hoover's style, was to let these people know that he had his information. Did it have any impact on government and governing, you know, because he was Attorney General, and I was wondering if it had any effect on any of the policies he was trying to develop while he was a government official. That Hoover, you know, he may have been keeping Hoover in mind when he was doing something?
I never picked up that. You know, there was a lot of conflict between Bobby Kennedy and Hoover, and Bobby actually did get Hoover into organized crime. But also, by the way, it was Johnson who got Hoover into going after the Ku Klux Klan, and the FBI was very successful at that. There was a lot of, you know, misunderstanding about the FBI and blacks. Partly because Hoover did have this vendetta against Martin Luther King.
Right, we'll talk about him.
Yeah, But right. but the fact is that the FBI wiped out the Ku Klux Klan. You can't do better than that.
Right. Right. That was one of the feathers in her cap. But, you know, I'm wondering, devoting all these man hours to the personal lives of government officials, I mean, that's you know, that's not really, you know, legal or whatever, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. That's right. You know, and meanwhile, you know, a lot of spies, real spies, were going free
right.
because,
right.
you know.
So, so you think it had an effect on the FBI and its work?
Yeah, there was a lot of wasted time on just getting scurrilous rumors, and Hoover, you know, would confuse legitimate political dissent with real spying,
right.
and that meant that not only did he trample on American rights, but also that real spies got away.
Right.
So that was a major problem.
Right.
I think of Hoover as, you know, 50% patriot and 50%. Monster, and monster is really a good word because
right.
so many people were afraid of him, and legitimately so.
Right. But it would be very difficult for someone to have that kind of power today, right? In
yeah,
government.
No, it was a totally different era, and
right.
Absolutely could not happen today, no.
Right. Well, what was his, looking and talking with people, what was his obsession with Martin Luther King? Was he a racist? That was it? He didn't like the fact that King... you know, was leading the civil rights movement?
I don't think it, I mean, I think that could have been part of it, but mainly I really think he was jealous of Martin Luther King, the fact that he got the Nobel Prize, and that at the same time he considered him a hypocrite because he did go to orgies, had affairs, you know, at first Hoover started investigating him because of because there were two people in his organization who were communists, but then, based on wiretaps, Hoover found out that they really didn't have any influence over King, and
right.
therefore there was no problem, no reason to continue
right.
investigating, and yet he did.
Right.
So I really think, you know, again, Hoover was a big egotistical individual and felt in competition with King.
Right. Hoover's monitoring of Martin Luther King have an impact on the civil rights campaign?
No, not really. It was pretty much kept secret. Hoover did try to leak some of it to some journalists, most of whom didn't want to hear it. But really, you know, the people in the civil rights movement really didn't know about it except when Hoover did call King a liar. But, you know, at the same time, as I said, the FBI was going after the Ku Klux
right.
Klan, and so really doing their job.
Right. And those famous tapes just came out with Jackie Kennedy, and, you know, she called Martin Luther King a phony after she listened to the FBI tapes. What's your opinion of that, and did you listen to those tapes or have access to them?
I didn't, but, you know, what she's referring to is the sexual activities
right.
That went on.
Right. What's your final opinion of Dr. King? Do you think it tarnishes his legacy?
No, I think, you know, what he did stands out as being very heroic and very historic and very important, and the sexual activities, you know, are certainly unfortunate, but don't really take away from what he achieved.
Right. Well, we've got a few minutes here, and we want to talk about some of the recent stuff. I know there was some, I think it was new information on a recent raid on Bin Laden's compound about the fingerprints not matching.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. What was that about, and what does it mean?
Right. Well, the FBI was quite involved in the whole operation because they trained the Navy SEALs on what to look for in terms of evidence and hard drives and thumb drives and
mm-hmm.
how to package it up. And then the FBI took custody of all the material, over 100 items, at the FBI laboratory. And what they tried to match his fingerprints,
mm-hmm.
and what they found, they thought that they had Bin Laden's fingerprints on some documents that had been seized earlier,
right.
and it turned out that was not true. They did not match, and so his fingerprints were never matched. On the other hand, the FBI did match his DNA and used facial recognition software to identify him. So he was Bin Laden, but his fingerprints will never be matched.
Right. The FBI, of course, investigated 9/11. Did you uncover anything that you found interesting relating to their investigation of 9/11 that people might not know about?
What I brought out in the book was just how overwhelmed the FBI was before that. They had terrible computers because of Louis Freeh, the director at the time, who didn't believe in technology, didn't even use email himself, and they were using computers that were green screened, didn't have internet, didn't have mouse, just ridiculous. And that was one of the problems. There was also this political correctness. They couldn't look at chat rooms where any 12-year-old could go. They couldn't go into mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And that has all changed.
Right.
It's now become a very prevention-oriented agency, meaning, you know, the first priority is get leads, get clues to the next plot, as opposed to prosecutions.
Right.
I got a question.
We got just about a minute, Willie.
One quick one. You know, one of our previous guests, Ms. Nina Natapoff, who wrote a book titled Snitching, Criminal Informants, and the Erosion of the American Justice System. The question begs this question. Are informants regular employees of the FBI?
We got about 30 seconds,
John. No, they're a separate category called informants, and they may be paid, but they're not employees.
Right. One last question. You can give us a somewhat. After going through talking with all these people at the FBI and all that, what's your feeling about the future of the FBI?
Well, I think under Robert Mueller, it's become a really first class operation that's a very powerful tool against terrorism.
Right.
And it needs the tools that it has to uncover plots. It needs the Patriot Act, and it needs other tools that it uses. There actually has not been an abuse the way there was under Hoover.
Right.
There's been sloppiness, there have been mistakes, but no actual abuse, meaning, you know, something for political purposes or improper purposes. And I think it has a great future, but, you know, it's so easy for that to change.
Right.
And that's why we do need to remain vigilant about the FBI.
Right. Well, thank you, Ron Kessler. This has been a great interview, and we really appreciate your appearance on our show. And the book is Secrets of the FBI, and it's available in all your bookstores, Amazon, and Ron Kessler's website. And thanks again, Ron. We hope to have you back on again.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Ron. Thank you.
Willie.
Well, thank you, and thank you again to our very special and fascinating guest, Mr. Ron Kessler. We were privileged to have him on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interview tonight?
Well, I think that, you know, that the FBI is a powerful institution, and given the way the war on terrorism is going, we're going to have to make sure we have safeguards in place to make sure the FBI doesn't become a secret police, because they're doing a lot of things that are very interesting, and they border touch right on civil liberties. What about you, Willie?
Well, Ronnie, I learned that the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, has the ways and means to dig into anybody's life and get the real dirt on these individuals, man.
Amen.
It just goes to show you how thorough and nefarious they could be if they wanted to be.
Right.
I'm telling you, they're
right.
Quite the organization. Right. I forgot to ask, Ron, how one gets into the FBI.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're not eligible.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure if I wanted to be anyway, but
yeah,
maybe if I was a young man, you never know, because it's an exciting career, I'm sure.
Right.
Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat's Dumb Crook of the Month segment. Well, a man who had spent 20 years in prison for bank robbery way back in the 60s thought he would try again in Spotsylvania County, Virginia. He demanded and received several thousand dollars from a bank, from two surprised bank cashiers, and he fled with spilled $100 notes in his wake as he attempted to stuff the cash into his pockets and get away. When he reached a hired getaway car, the stupid criminal realized he had locked the keys in the car. The bungling burglar promptly took to his heels and fled the scene on foot, followed by two passerbys who grabbed him. The fleeing felon attempted to pull out his gun but failed and shot himself in the leg, but kept fighting his would-be arresters. One of them were who shot the suspect. The local police have charged the robber with 8 felonies, including robbery and 2 counts of attempted murder. The suspect was attended to in hospital and recovered. Hey, Ronnie, you can't make these things up, man.
Right. This is one dumb crook who should have stayed in prison, right? He's not only a menace to society, he's a menace to himself. And thank heaven, law and order, that we have dumb crooks in the world, right?
That's
like
for sure.
Like this one.
That's for sure. Well, we'll come up with another dumb crook next time around, next cycle. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for October the 13th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our featured guest will be Mr. Henry Hill, the legendary former American mobster and associate of the infamous Lucchese crime family. Henry Hill's life was immortalized in the book Wise Guy, written by the crime reporter Nicholas Pileggi, and the 1990 Martin Scorsese classic film titled Goodfellas, starring Ray Liotta and Robert De Niro. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. Now, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all you listeners out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat program anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. We'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. And in the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. If you want to support our broadcast, make a contribution to Crime Beat via the Artist First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page of the website for your quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.